Hello and welcome to Think Ahead, a London Business School podcast which offers evidence-based discussions and insights to help you navigate big business issues. I'm Julian Birkinshaw, Professor of Strategy and Entrepreneurship and Vice Dean at London Business School, as well as the host of our Think Ahead podcast series. We have a vibrant entrepreneurship program at London Business School, and we're proud to have helped launch many entrepreneurial careers. Our faculty also produce a lot of research on the topic of entrepreneurship. So with this in mind, we wanted to explore topics relating to female entrepreneurship. As we will hear, women's experiences can be very different from that of male entrepreneurs, and it's often much harder. So in this podcast, we will explore the obstacles that need to be overcome by women and their allies to pave the pathway to running a successful business. How far do we have to go to achieve a fair representation of female entrepreneurs across the board? What can we do to mitigate obstacles that stand in the way of success? To discuss this topic, I'm delighted to welcome Rupa Patel, founder and CEO of Entrepreneura, and Olenka Kasperchik, Professor of Strategy and Entrepreneurship at London Business School.
Thank you, Julian.
Thank you very much. Pleasure to be here.
Rupa, just tell us a little bit about yourself.
So I'm an LBS 2013 alumna. I founded, while I was at LBS, my first company, which is in real estate construction and development. And then about 6 years ago, set up Entrepreneura, where I help organizations develop their future talent.
Perfect. Thanks very much. Olenka, tell us a little bit about yourself.
I'm Olenka Kasperchik, and I'm an entrepreneurship and strategy professor here at London Business School. And I do research on entrepreneurship with a particular focus on female founders.
Let's start with the nature of the challenge. The evidence says that there are fewer female than male entrepreneurs out there. In the US, for example, entrepreneurial activity amongst men is roughly twice the rate of women. In the UK, something like 6% of women entrepreneurs versus 15% of men. And I'd like just to explore what's going on there. There's obviously lots of factors at play. Rupa, why don't you give us a sense from your own research and your own intuition?
First and foremost, women just don't get funded. So I think the statistics are probably skewed because those numbers that you just shared are probably funded later stage organizations where women don't even get to that next level because they are simply not getting the funding or access to the funding at the same rates as men do. And some of that is just systemic barriers. Some of it is just good old-fashioned sexism, mm-hmm. which we can delve into a little bit. Mm-hmm. And some of it is also the lack of it being as socially acceptable for women to fail as it is for men to fail.
Indeed. Olenka, do you want to just give me your high-level thoughts on that? We're going to delve into a couple of your specific studies first, but what are the other factors? I'm sure you recognize what Rupa just said.
Yeah, absolutely. So I just wanted to mention that there's a lot of research trying to understand what are those factors that account for the systematic barriers that we see that prevent women from becoming founders. And so at the broader level, I would say they're classified into two separate categories. So the first category is exactly what Rupa mentioned, which is we're always thinking about bias, we're thinking about negative stereotypes that in particular prevent VCs, prevent financiers from really entrusting women with money, with capital, with other resources that they need in order to succeed. And that, I would think, is the common explanation. Now, if we think a little bit more about what actually is driving these persistent gaps that we observe in female entrepreneurship, then I would also add that the second category is around the pipeline problems. Mm. And the pipeline might reflect a number of different issues. So some of them are reflecting structural problems. So for example, when we think about structural constraints in the workplace, so the fact that women often are less likely to occupy high-level positions. And so because of that, they're also less likely to access resources, to have exposure to opportunities, to have networks that are needed for them to both come up with an idea for a new venture, but then also mobilize resources to found those ventures. And so it's not only the evaluations, the bias that we observe, but also the actual structural problems in the workplace.
And there's no reason to think there's any capability or even innate motivational barrier. It's more that the women who might want to become entrepreneurs, they face a whole raft of obstacles and barriers that just make it difficult to go from idea to, you know, to funding to successful business.
Yeah, and I think some of it is actually there is this very stubborn idea that actually it is a lack of capability and a lack of desire and a lack of risk-taking, when the reality is just not the case. And I think, you know, the way I see it, the fact that we even need to justify with research that it should look more equal is part of the problem itself, right? So I think there is this ingrained bias that just assumes, oh, well, the reason we don't see more women out there in as entrepreneurs is because they don't have it in them. They want comfortable lives. They're not as risk-taking. When the reality is, it's not just a pipeline problem, it's an echo chamber problem. It's, you know, the world of entrepreneurship looks a very specific unigendered way. And then it's just that network that who looks investable, who is investable, who do you know, who have you heard of? I am part of many networks of women founders. And I can tell you without a single doubt in my mind that there are dozens, if not thousands of them who are underfunded, facing structural barriers, facing social barriers, et cetera, that are keeping them from rising to the top. It's not that they don't exist. It's people aren't looking for them in the same way.
Mm-hmm. So, Olenka, I'd like to just dig into a couple of your specific studies, because this is, London Business School is a research institution. We always like to try to actually showcase proper academic research. One of your studies called Do Employees Work Less for Female Leaders? What's the answer to that question?
The answer is yes. And the question is by how much and why it matters.
Yeah, exactly. Just give us a sense of what's going on there.
Yeah, so this is a very interesting study because in general, we tend to think about those pre-entry constraints that women face. So those are the ones that we've just mentioned. So all those structural barriers that prevent women from becoming founders. Now, it turns out that even if we remove those barriers, so even if we see women succeeding at founding those ventures, still we observe that they face systematic hurdles when it comes to growth, when it comes to scaling, when it comes to attracting people and motivating their employees. And so with that, we then ask this question, well, why? What's going on? Mm-hmm. What's happening when women try to deploy the workforce, when they try to actually get labor on which startups inherently and deeply depend? So our intuition was that, well, perhaps it's just much harder to get this extra discretionary effort that is just so needed for new ventures. Now, of course, the problem is, well, how do you test that? How do you measure discretionary effort for the same task, for the same person? And so what we've done to actually pin that down is we conducted a bunch of experiments as the first step, where we randomly assign workers to startups with founders of different genders. So people were working either for a founder who was a male or a female, and then everything else was the same between the startups. Now, what was interesting is that we asked them to provide discretionary effort. So overtime work that was not paid, we asked them how willing they would be to do that. And so the findings were striking. So it turns out that when it comes to labor supply, just pure labor supply, employees were much less likely to provide that labor to women than to men. And in general, it means that workers worked on average 1.4 hours less a month for women than for men. And that's huge. That's actually huge if you're a founder, because if you are a female founder, then you have to pay much more to get the same labor as compared to being a male founder.
And were the workers, shall we say, aware that they were even doing this? Do you see what I mean? And perhaps you couldn't test that.
That's right. So probably it was an implicit bias, although we did ask follow-up questions around how did you feel about the task? How did you feel about providing discretionary extra effort? And so what we found was that employees were more likely to report that it was unfair to ask for more labor, the labor was more difficult when the founder was a woman. Now, I will say we need to know more why that is, but of course, that was something striking.
I will get you to comment in a second, Rupal, but let's just talk about the other study, which is called the Motherhood Wage Penalty. And again, just give us the kind of the 30-second version of what that that paper does.
Yeah, so just to set the background, so in general, we tend to think that women pursue entrepreneurship to resolve work-life conflicts. So the idea is that because women face disproportionate family demands, they have to look for solutions that allow them for greater flexibility. And so past studies show that women often would treat entrepreneurship as the so-called plan B, which means that they would go to self-employment, to stay at home, to have sort of those home-based operations. But the question in this study was, well, what about career motivations? Do women also found new ventures to advance their careers? And so the big finding was that women who become mothers in paid employment are more likely to face significant earning penalties. And this is because usually employers would infer that women with children are not as committed, they're just not as reliable, and so therefore we know there's significant discrimination for women who become mothers in the context of paid employment. Now, what we observed in this study, and this was based on the entire Swedish population, wow, just to be clear, so we looked at every single person in Sweden, we compared mothers to non-mothers for the same task in the same organization, and then we looked at what happens when a woman becomes a mother. And so what we found was that women who become mothers face significant wage penalties, but then in addition, following that event, they're much more likely to found a new venture. And these ventures are incorporated. They're the ones that actually are very highly performing, and they allow women to escape that wage penalty that they face in wage work.
RuPaul, couple of academic studies. Do you want to either build on them or challenge them?
So there's some additional research in America around this idea of the glass cliff, that when women do reach leadership positions, finally break through the you know, what we used to call the glass ceiling. It's the same exact thing. Employees, senior leaders, which are, again, very often men, will pull back, will work less hard, will sometimes actively try to sabotage. So you have these subtle things happening, and again, the research bears this out, but you also have these very obvious overt things happening where it's challenging vocally female leaders in, you know, sort of town hall settings, or questioning their credibility. There's a brilliant book coming out about this called The Glass Cliff, in which they cite one of many instances, for example, where a woman leader was giving a town hall address in the financial services industry, and one of the men in the audience shouted out while she was delivering this keynote, I don't understand what you're saying. Are you high? Now, you wouldn't exactly. There are gasps all around, right? Because this sounds unthinkable. It's ridiculous, and it's not. And so it's overt things like that. And then going back to when women become pregnant, there's great work being done by an organization here called Pregnant Then Screwed that looks at pregnancy discrimination, and it is shocking to hear the number of women who are overtly told by their employers to get an abortion, to fix the problem somehow, because you're not promotable otherwise. So let's not be, you know, sort of sugarcoating this. The reality is often far darker than many people can admit. And then there are NDAs, and there's all this sort of suppression, and so people can't sort of come out overtly and sort of talk about their experiences. So there's a lot of stuff going on. It's not just about, oh, well, you know, it's not fair. There's some really insidious things happening, and it creates a sort of a hostile environment that, why, for many people, many women, why wouldn't you just choose to opt out instead of facing that?
Absolutely. But I would say that there's silver lining with entrepreneurship here, because indeed what we found was that this is a way to advance and to get ahead and to overcome some of those significant obstacles that you face in the workplace. So I think entrepreneurship can be seen by women as the social mobility vehicle.
So we're going to get to some of the solutions in a second. I just wanted to throw out the one study, which I remember reading this like 5 years ago. It was a bunch of researchers at MIT in the US, and they actually got male and female voices dubbed onto PowerPoint presentations, and they asked investors if they would invest in these pitches for new business. And so they kept the actual content of the presentations identical, and just merely the fact that it was a male voice rather than a female voice doubled the likelihood that the person would invest. So I think all I'm doing is kind of agreeing with you that there are a number of structural factors often implicit biases out there. So we must turn to solutions, because ultimately we have to be optimistic that there is a pathway forward. For those based in the UK, you might be aware of the Rose Review. This was Alison Rose, former chief exec of NatWest Bank. And this study was, I think, published in 2022. And it was all about essentially trying to increase the number of women entrepreneurs. And I believe that from even in the period from the beginning of the review to the end of the review, the number of female entrepreneurs actually grew quite significantly. That review estimated that if women were entrepreneurs at the same rate of men, you would unlock £250 billion worth of value. That's a big number. We don't necessarily have to go all the way there, but clearly there is untapped potential. One of the things that they talk about is the investing in women code. Mm. Now, can one of you talk a little bit about what that is? I don't know, perhaps you don't know the detail of it, but.
So I've actually done some work with the Rose Review, and it's basically organizations agree to provide financial access and additional either sort of educational or mentoring support, but to create the sort of full, almost like a mini accelerator. Mm-hmm. So it's pulling it together for the specific outcome of creating and generating a larger pipeline of female-founded businesses.
Right.
So it's everything from the financial to the practical.
And they get corporations, I believe 134 have signed up for mm-hmm. this, to sign up to do the following, to do
Correct.
The stuff that you talked
and
about.
And they have to, you know, go through effectively a checklist of things that they will commit
right.
to.
Right. And is it too early to say whether, I guess it is too early to say whether there are any outcomes from this, because this was only set up 2 years ago.
Yeah, I think in my personal view now, you know, they send updates every year, and there's measurable, if in my view, far too little progress being made at every stage. But I think it is too early because, mm-hmm. you know, it's 2-3 years. And the reality is also companies and organizations can commit to something, but until the money actually changes hands, until the resources are actually being deployed, it's hard to know how much of that is just really good PR and how much is actually having an impact.
Indeed. No, and like many worthy initiatives, it's very easy to sort of play lip service to it rather
exactly.
than to actually do it. So I don't doubt for a second that this is a good initiative, but let's talk more broadly. What are some of the other opportunities we've got for unblocking and challenging some of these structural barriers? Olenka, what do you think?
So I tend to think about policy as a big hammer we have in our mm-hmm. hands. So mm-hmm. so this is a big lever that we can leverage. And so in a bunch of different studies that I've conducted, I noticed that policy makes difference, right? Mm. And so we can assuage or reduce those barriers by having policy play to our advantage. And so, for example, one thing that I discovered in one of the studies, this was conducted in Portugal, was that it's not just about financing. So often what happens is that women need time to pool resources, to mobilize resources, to found a new venture. It's very time consuming to found a new venture. And so the moment we create policies that reduce the administrative barriers, the time needed to found a new venture, that's what really makes a huge difference for women. And so we found that in Portugal in particular, when the administrative barriers were reduced, the rate of female founders
right?
just skyrocketed.
So obviously reduced barriers for all, but you're saying it particularly helps
women. It particularly disproportionately helps women. And it's not just about financing. That's the important point to make, because women need time. They're time constrained. And so anything we can do at the level of let's reduce the time it takes, that's really going to make a difference for women.
And the other policy initiatives that cross your mind? I mean, we can play with tax rates, we can play with, you know, incentives of different types.
Absolutely. So one that I think we rarely think about is one around also increasing employment in startups. So that's something we haven't talked about yet, because women, they can be part of the entrepreneurial ecosystem as founders, but also we can think about them as being joiners, as working for startups. And that's another way to really contribute to the entrepreneurial ecosystem. And so again, when we look at research, we notice that women tend to be underrepresented as startup workers. But at the policy level, and this is yet another study I conducted, there are things we can do. We can lower barriers to termination. We can make it easier for employers to try out, to to give women a chance to work in startups, because again, there's these biases that we talked about. There's the question of fit. Can women commit to a startup employer? And so the moment we have policies that allow for an easier experimentation, I would call it experimentation with a worker, that's where we can see that that it really makes a difference, and we see increased representation of women in startup workforce.
Excellent. Rupal, other thoughts in terms of things we can do to
definitely
help?
So there are two things. One is closing what I often refer to as the visibility gap, because I think you know, if you ask anyone on the street, name an entrepreneur, name a founder, name a leader, name a scientist, an inventor, an artist, inevitably the person that are going to conjure up is going to be more often than not an image of a white male. And that's not because women and non-white people don't exist in these fields and don't excel in these fields. It's just we don't hear their stories. We don't celebrate their stories. We don't normalize their stories in the same way that we do, for example, the stories of, you know, that endless parade of white men that we're often celebrating. And it's not to say it has to be either or, but for example.
I won't mention any white male entrepreneurs.
Yeah.
You give us three or four examples of successful female entrepreneurs.
Whitney Wolf Hurd, who started Bumble and is a unicorn business itself. And she left because of, again, a toxic, she co-founded, I think it was Tinder, and then had to exit because of that toxic situation. There is Michelle Monet here in the UK. There's Sarah Blakely in the US, who recently had held it privately and then was recently partly acquired by Blackstone. So the success stories are there. But for whatever reason, even though women can make up 51% of the population, our stories are often considered niche and are niched in sort of the women's sections of magazines or the women's conferences or women's entrepreneurship. We are doing amazing things. People just need to talk about it, look for it, and celebrate those stories in the same way that they do when men are doing it.
No, indeed. And Michelle Moon, unfortunately, has been getting a lot of bad press recently. And I can't help thinking if she'd been male, she wouldn't have got quite the same negative publicity that she got.
I think the standards are just very different, right? So we have given Elon Musk a limitless leash, for example, right? No one expects good behavior out of men, but women have to be unimpeachable in their character, in the way they look, the way they behave, the way they sound. There are all of these invisible standards that inevitably we're going to fall foul of, where the standards are just simply not there. And I often joke, you know, sort of in this, the biases that we all have about what leadership looks like and what good leadership looks like, because our sort of, especially here in the West, our history of corporate leadership, government leadership at all levels has effectively been, you know, white men for centuries. No one has ever said, oh, well, you know, white men have been behind World Wars One and Two and economic crashes and booms and bust cycles and the failures of banks and the failures of this. Oh, we should never let white men lead again, right? It's laughable. It's stupid to say it, right? But somehow, when women take those same positions, or a person of color takes up a leadership position, their failure is somehow attached to their gender, to their difference. Yes. And again, it's that thing of we're not allowed to fail in the same way. And I think we need to shake up that narrative that it is, you know, we shouldn't universalize a single individual's performance, but we often do that for women.
Yeah. Olenka, what are your thoughts on particularly finding good role models? I mean, at London Business School, for example, one little initiative I've been involved with is trying to increase our funding for case studies that we teach in the classroom, where the protagonist is female, for example. I mean, what are your thoughts on that? Do you have any examples of famous female entrepreneurs you want to share with us, or perhaps how you teach the topic to your students, just to try to, you know, get over some of these challenges?
Yeah, so it's inherently difficult, I would say. So finding those role models is really difficult. I would say, though, that one thing that I tend to think about is the parental role model. So I was lucky enough to grow up in a family where essentially everyone is an entrepreneur. And from the get-go, I was exposed to those role models. And now it's interesting because there's research that shows that parents have enormous influence on whether women, men tend to transition to entrepreneurship, whether they become inventors later in their life. And so what we know is that, in fact, women who grow up in families where parents are entrepreneurs or inventors are significantly less likely to become entrepreneurs or inventors relative to their male siblings.
No one.
And so it turns out that the reason for it is that parents anticipate that if a woman, if a girl becomes a founder, she becomes an inventor, she's going to have much lower returns to it. And so they anticipate those difficulties already. And I think this is where all those barriers that we talked about at the beginning, this is where they already become created right at the get-go. And so even just at the level of parental role modeling and transmission of those roles, this is where it all starts, and this is where we should be thinking about.
Got it. We're running towards the end of the podcast. Just a couple of final questions. One was, what can male allies do to support this set of challenges and opportunities that we're discussing there? That would be one. And then secondly, I noticed that International Women's Day this year, the theme is inspiring inclusion. Do either of you have a kind of a thought on either of those two slightly different points? And then we'll wrap up.
Yeah, so allies, invest in women. It is that simple. I think, you know, so there are many other barriers, but if we genuinely want to change the statistics from 2% of VC funding going to women-led organization companies to something a little bit more rational, mm-hmm. I think just as an investment thesis, the fact that only 2% goes to women-led business is doesn't make sense to me. So I think just invest in women. And similarly with things like International Women's Day, organizations need to actually put their money where their mouth is. So do you pay your women equally if you are celebrating International Women's Day? Are you paying, you know, for the events that you are doing to celebrate International Women's Day? Do you offer additional support to enable the women in your organization to stay in your organization, whether they choose to become parents or not? Put your money where your mouth is. We've been talking about these issues for far too long. Yeah. People need to pay up.
Yeah. Alenka?
And not only invest in women, but also hire women if you are a founder, because most startups are male founded. And so we know that people are much more likely to become founders when they work for a startup, because this is where they learn. And so there's a little bit of a chicken and egg problem. Women don't tend to work in startups, and so therefore they're not likely to become founders. So if you are a male founder, then make sure that you hire women so that they can learn, they can acquire all those skills, and they can become founders themselves.
And contribute to your organization in ways that you wouldn't have necessarily had if you had a very myopic view of the world, experience of the world. I think it's not just about, oh, it's a charitable and a philosophical thing to do. It makes good common sense business practice to have your different views represented.
Perfect. We will finish there on that very uplifting and practical note. Thank you, Rupal and Alenka, for joining us today and sharing your experience and insights.
Thank you very much. I enjoyed the discussion.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
You've been listening to Think Ahead, brought to you by the editorial team at Think at London Business School. Follow us here for more episodes, or find us on Apple or Spotify. For more faculty research, insights and information about our Think Ahead event and podcast series, go to london.edu/think. You can also sign up there for our free regular email newsletter to get updates on our latest publications direct to your inbox.